I'm Dr. Rhoda Hawkins. I'm from the University of Sheffield Department of Physics. So it's my pleasure to welcome Professor John Wyatt to be our first speaker. For those of you who don't know him, he's based at University College London. He has a dual role. He's Professor of Ethics and Perinatology, but he's also a consultant neonatologist at the hospital, both UCL, University College London, the university and the university hospital. Who better to address the question of what it means to be human? And this is a fantastic talk to start our day discussing these really interesting issues. So, John.
Well, thank you very much. It's a privilege for me to be able to take on this huge and mind-boggling topic. And of course, in the short time available to us, I can't attempt to be in any way comprehensive. I think what I'd like to do is reflect on the way that understandings of what it means to be human have so often been influenced by technology. And it's an interesting theme over the course of intellectual history, how the best technology of the time has been used to try to understand what it means to be human. And a good example of this is in the Enlightenment period, when clockwork was, in many ways, the most precision clocks were the most sophisticated forms of technology that were available. And Diderot wrote about the way that a human being can be thought of like a precision clock. His heart is the mainspring, and his head are the bells, complete with little hammers. The soul is the tiny figure on the top, listening to the music of the chimes. And so in an age of clockwork, the idea that the human, and particularly the human brain, is basically clockwork. Very interesting that already, people like Diderot and other philosophers of the Enlightenment were thinking about the possibility of human enhancement. Diderot wrote a very interesting essay speculating on how clockwork could be used to actually enhance what it means to be human. And it's interesting that it's probably taken sort of 250 years for the technology to catch up so that those Enlightenment dreams can now start to become realistic. But those ideas have been around for a long time. Again, hydraulics and steam power was when that, in the 19th century, the age of hydraulics, it's not surprising that hydraulic imagery of humanity was very common. Many people have suggested that the whole Freudian view of psychology and of the human psyche is basically hydraulics. You've got this incompressible fluid, the libido, which builds up and then comes bursting out in all kinds of ways. I mean, this is just hydraulics applied to psychology. We shouldn't be surprised, however, that in our age, the dominant technology is now the computer and the supercomputer, and therefore it's information processing. And the computer, which is the technology which will most reveal what it means to be human. And it's interesting how the sort of grand narrative of humanity is itself evolving. I think we're all familiar with the left-hand part of this picture, of the evolution of humanity out of previous life forms emerging, and humanity as the pinnacle of the process of evolution over billions of years. But actually, increasingly now, that narrative is changing. Many people, secular thinkers, regarding humanity as simply a transitional stage in this great onward rush of progress. And that the future lies actually not with what some people term our meat children, that is our physical children made out of meat, as we are, because that's using the analogy that we're simply machines, computers made out of meat. But actually, some people are arguing, for instance, Max Tegmark, if you're interested in following this further, he's written a book called Life 3.0. And Life 3.0 is actually the non-meat. It's the machines. So he says that the machines are our real children. They are our mind children. And the future belongs to our mind children because it's the machines that are going to go on. And long after Homo sapiens and all those biological species have died out, it's our mind children, the machines that come after us, that are going to continue on into the future. So here is another sort of new grand narrative that sees humanity as merely a transitional stage. This is Martin Rees, is a proponent of this kind of thinking. Astronomer Royal, as you know. Abstract thinking by biological brains has underpinned the emergence of all culture and science, but this activity, spanning tens of millennia at most, will be a brief precursor to the more powerful intellects of the inorganic post-human era. And Martin Rees goes on to say that it's clear that humanity, Homo sapiens, is particularly adapted to this particular little ecosystem on planet Earth, but we're desperately maladapted to the rest of the universe. And therefore, we're always going to be limited into this very small ecological sphere, whereas it's the machines that are the ones that are adapted to propagate across the solar system and then ultimately to propagate across the cosmos, and they will take our human ideas. So there's a grand narrative which puts the machines at the center. And I think going along with that, one of the things which strikes me, and I recommend that you look out for this, because I spot it increasingly in secular discourse from scientists and others, is a kind of disgust, a kind of self-loathing about what it means to be human. So this is the kind of stuff that we come across. We are pathetic, ludicrous, laughable bipeds who are only fit for survival on the African savannah. Our bodies are a pathetic hodgepodge of partly functioning biological engineering, subject to frequent breakdown and inexorable decline. Our brains are dominated by reptilian reflexes from our biological ancestors, which frequently function in inappropriate ways. They're maladapted to modern society. Our information processing capacity is limited and subject to frequent errors. Every time we access a memory, we distort and change the encoded file, leading to gross errors. Our perceptions of reality are highly distorted, and our brains create an imaginary reality for survival purposes. So, with that kind of perspective of what it means to be human, it's pretty obvious that the machines actually seem rather better. They're rather better suited to information processing. They're rather better suited to the challenges of the modern world. So I suspect that as we become increasingly influenced by intelligent machines, as our world is dominated by intelligent machines, there's a two-way psychological process going on between the humans and the machines. On the one hand, there's a movement from the machines to the humans. We understand what it means to be human, and in particular the working of the human brain, by looking at machines, especially computing machines. So it's striking that modern people increasingly understand themselves as machine-like. It's machine analogies which are frequently used as we try to understand what it means to be human. But at the same time, there's the opposite move, that there's a move from the human to the machine. We put our own humanity onto the machine. We understand what it means to be an intelligent machine by looking at our own humanity. And this is the instinctive process of anthropomorphism, which all of us as human beings seem to be very prone to develop and respond to. So to put it diagrammatically, here are the human and the machine, which historically have been seen as entirely separate categories of being. But now we're having these moves, on the one hand, with increasing mechanical understandings of humanity going one way, and then anthropomorphism going back onto the machines. So the mechanical analogies we often hear are these kind of things, people being hardwired, being programmed. Max Tegmark's definition of life is a self-replicating information processing system. That's what we are. That's what life is. And these kind of mechanical understandings. So Marvin Minsky, a robotics pioneer, just says the human brain is a machine made out of meat and a computing machine. I think at the heart of that kind of thinking, there's a deep confusion about the difference between a metaphor and a fundamental description. So when we say that the brain is a machine, we are confusing the distinction between a metaphor and description. There are many aspects of being human and of the human brain which are machine-like. In other words, it's actually quite a helpful metaphor. And arguably, many aspects of, for instance, computational neuroscience, neuropsychology, and so on, is using machine analogies, machine metaphors, as a way of understanding what it means to be human. But it's a deeply false and incoherent thing to say that the mind or the brain is a machine. Since a machine, by definition, is an artifact created by human beings for human purposes. That's what it means to define. So when you say that the brain is a machine, you've immediately confused that fundamental description. So I think understanding and helping other people, including scientists, who often are not very good at the sort of more careful and logical thinking about philosophy and so on, understanding and helping people to understand the difference between a helpful metaphor and a basic description, I think that's going to be very important as we go forward. And then what about this other move, anthropomorphism, anthropomorphe, to see a human form in a non-human being. It's interesting that most robotic manufacturers have decided that rather than go for beings that are designed to replicate a human as accurately as possible, they feel that it's actually better to create beings that we just naturally anthropomorphize with, that we find unthreatening, cuddly, cute. And so manufacturers have worked out that using this kind of almost childlike or unthreatening kind of product which we anthropomorphize with is actually commercially and in other ways valuable. I had a very interesting experience about a year ago. I was at a conference for church leaders, and including some very eminent church leaders and bishops and so on, and we were discussing some of these issues about the philosophy of artificial intelligence and the theological implications and so on, and much deep sort of thinking. And then, as part of the conference, this group of about 40 senior church people go on a visit to the local computer lab. And this group walk into a lab, and on the floor were about five of these little Nio robots. They are about 18 inches tall. They were all switched on, their eyes were flashing, their arms were moving, and they were speaking. And as this group of senior church people walk into the lab, instantly the atmosphere changes. And a diocesan bishop, no less, gets down on his hands and knees and says, "Oh, hello, look at the little darlings. Hello, how are you?" And people are waving and smiling. And I'm watching this and thinking, you know, what hope have we got? If this is the way that senior church leaders respond when they meet these things, what hope is there for the rest of us? And it made me reflect on the fact that anthropomorphism is something that's under conscious control. It's something that we do instantaneously and without thought. And a second thing that I was reflecting is that most of these church leaders, both male and female, would have been parents and would have themselves cared for young children, including toddlers. And something all of us who care for children know is that if you come across, you walk into a room and you come across a toddler wandering along the floor, you don't ignore them. you immediately engage and say, oh, hello, how are you? And are you lost? And where's your mummy and daddy? And all that. That's a sort of instinctive response of a parent towards a child. And the manufacturers are playing on that, that instinctive response of the way that we respond to toddlers, in order to drive us to this anthropomorphism. But it's something that I think is potentially very manipulative and coercive, because, of course, these childlike artifacts can be connected through the cloud to the most astonishing computing ability and ability to analyze facial expressions and process and respond in real time and so on, so that their appearance of this harmless little childlike being could actually be profoundly deceptive and manipulative. But I think in the future we're going to come across these kind of simulated persons in all kinds of different guises. Some of them are going to be incarnate in a sort of physical three-dimensional form. Some of them are going to be avatars on a screen. This is Ellie, who's a virtual therapist. And you can see the technology is used so that the client, the human client, faces the screen, and their facial expressions, movements, body postures, and so on are constantly analyzed. Using highly sophisticated technology. I think Peter Robinson may well describe some of that technology later on. And then the avatar on the screen, Ellie, responds in real time. My wife, who is a professional counselor, watched the video clip and said, you know, this is so clever because this is exactly using the techniques that professional counselors will use. So we're going to meet simulated persons like as avatars on screens, and we're also going to meet them in a completely disembodied forms in software apps. So this is Eternity, where you can upload all your texts and emails and everything you've ever produced, so that after you've died, you continue to have a presence in the cloud. You can continue to send emails and texts. The artificial intelligence will generate text using all your previous data, and you can continue to be present. There's also something called replica, which is ideas to be a sort of alter ego. Again, you do the same kind of thing. You put all your text and you develop a quotes relationship with this being in the cloud, and then this being talks back to you and you have a conversation with it, and the idea is a bit like having a conversation with yourself. And so these virtual persons, I think many of the manufacturers want to have a virtual person in every room in our homes, a virtual person everywhere we go, in our workplaces, in our labs, everywhere. There'll be these beings talking to us, engaging with us, responding to us. So it's a confusing world. So I think these simulated persons, here's Google Home, as we know, Alexa and other, there's been a huge push from these big commercial organizations to make these virtual persons part of us. And one of the, again, confusing and troubling things is that because of our ability to anthropomorphize, if you take a humanoid robot and you do something unpleasant to it, you can show that the person who's watching this, the same kind of brain regions are activated, including empathic regions and so on, as if you were torturing a human person. And I think this is going to raise all kinds of troubling questions about whether there's going to have to be laws about what you're allowed to do with humanoid robots, whether the whole regulation of just as there are laws about what we're allowed to do with kittens, for instance, and with vulnerable animals, is that primarily because we are so concerned about kittens? Or is it more that we don't wish to live in a society in which people can torture animals with abandon, that it says something about us? And I think in the same way, do we want to be part of a society where people can torture robots, human-like robots, for fun, while they scream and plead for mercy? Do we want to be part of a society where people can abuse sex robots, including child sex robots, and so on? So there are many troubling and complex issues which we're going to face, and it's because of our humanity, because of our instinctive ability to engage, to empathize, and respond. So anthropomorphism is a universal human tendency which is largely outside conscious control. It's part of our humanity. It brings profound positive benefits. I mean, as a as a clinician, I know how important it is, and I teach medical students about how important it is to empathize, to try to understand, to see through the patient's eyes. But of course, that very process also opens us up to manipulation and deception. And I was very struck by these words from a journalist. He says, human compassion can be gamed. It's the ultimate psychological hack, a glitch in human response that can be exploited in an attempt to make a sticky product. That's why designers give AIs human characteristics in the first place. They want us to like them. So I think we live in a very troubling, complex, challenging time. There are many, of course, many positive benefits that will come from developing technology. But I think this question about what it means to be human and how as humans we respond in this landscape will be complex and troubling. But there will also be opportunities, I think, for Christians. I find it helpful to think that in response to a sort of strong physicalism that says there is nothing but matter and energy, that it's helpful to think of another foundational category of reality that's not mind or consciousness, but I would describe it as personhood. That to be a person is something that is totally different. And I've been very influenced by the Trinitarian thinking of the Cappadocian Church Fathers, particularly in the 4th century AD. And what they taught could be summarized in one sense, that God's being consists of hypostases in ekstasis. Hypostasis, a Greek word meaning person, and in fact, the early Christians and the Church Fathers invested this Greek word with a very specific meaning. The Greek word already existed, and it really meant something like substance or what lay beneath. But the Church Fathers invested this word, hypostasis, with a very new and profound meaning. And they said that to be a person are the persons of the Trinity. The most fundamental definition of a person comes from the understanding of the Trinity as three persons, but who are giving themselves to one another. So ekstasis, the persons of the Trinity are constantly giving themselves to one another. The Father gives himself to the Son gives himself to the Father gives himself to the Spirit to the Father, and so on. So there is this movement within the Trinity of the persons giving themselves to one another. And in this way of thinking, I think personhood is a category of reality which is, to use a philosophical term, ontologically foundational. In other words, you cannot define a person in something more basic. I mean, there have been various attempts over the centuries to define personhood. For instance, sort of famous definition of a person was a rational substance of an individual nature. But as soon as you've done that, what you've done is you've made rationality and substance and individuality more basic than personhood. And it seems to me that I find it helpful to have this idea that to be a person is the most fundamental description. You cannot get any lower down than to say to be a person. To be a person is to be like the persons of the Trinity. And persons are not reducible to matter and energy, and they're not limited to matter and energy. Of course, in Orthodox Christian theology, the Holy Spirit is a person, but a completely immaterial person. Whereas Jesus Christ is a person who is also incarnate, who is both physical and immaterial. And in this way of thinking, persons are constituted by their relations. Their being is derived from the movement or communion, from the movement of communion, from the freedom to give oneself to the other. And so the Church Fathers said, the very being of the Father depends on the Son. The Father cannot be Father unless the Son exists. And similarly, the very being of the Son depends on the existence of the Father. So the beings of the persons is constituted by their relationships, by their relations. In some way, it's the existence of the persons which together constitutes their being. That's the self-giving love. And from this sort of exalted understanding of a person is that, well, what does a human person? Well, in this way of thinking, a human person is really defined, a sub-person that reflects the personhood of the Trinity, the persons of the Trinity. And so this is another way of thinking about the Imago Dei, that the image of God is, at least in part, because we are persons, inasmuch as the Trinity consists of persons. And therefore, to be a person is in some mysterious way to participate in the life of God, to participate in the divine life of the triune Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so, whereas the famous cogito, I think, therefore I am, of Descartes, we could perhaps replace a Trinitarian version that says, you love me, therefore I am. We are constituted by our relations. We're constituted in this movement to one another. Another aspect of this was highlighted by the Jewish existentialist philosopher Martin Buber. And I recently reread his book, and I recommend it to you. A short but very profound book, I and Thou. And he compares the I-Thou relationship, the I-You relationship, with the I-It relationship. And the I-You relationship is another aspect of that personhood, that it's only persons who can be involved in the I-You relation, as opposed to things which are involved in the I-It. In the Nicene Creed, the Church Fathers were trying to encapsulate the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. Was God the Son part of the creation? Was he created by his Father? And they came up with this formula in the Nicene Creed that the Son was eternally born of the Father, or begotten, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, born or begotten, not made. In other words, the relationship between the Father and the Son was of one of being, whereas the relationship between the Father and the creation was one of his will and his choice. So that which we give birth to is fundamentally the same as us. So our children come as a gift from our being, and they're equal to us in status and in dignity. We care for, nurture, and educate our children, but as all parents discover, we cannot control our children, and we cannot determine their nature. We cannot determine who our children are. It's given to them. It's part of their being. It's part of their gift. But if you contrast that with that which we make or create, and of course here the intelligent machines come in, that which we make or create is fundamentally different from us. It's a product of our will, and it's therefore ours to mold and control. And we can determine what a machine is for and what it will do. So that distinction between being born and being made does seem to me a pretty profound one that we perhaps need to reflect on further. And then thinking particularly about transhumanism, and Justin's going to be talking in much more detail later on, I do think that the resurrection of Christ, we were meditating earlier on, weren't we, about the whole Christ event, about the incarnation, the cross and the resurrection. In Christ's physical resurrection as a recognizable, touchable human being, it's been said that God has said the final yes to original model humanity, to the Mark 1 human Homo sapiens. He said that this kind of humanity, embodied humanity, is fit to be transformed. It will be renewed. So in God's mysterious purposes, this is what human beings were always intended to become. We were always intended to be resurrected, to be transformed, but as embodied beings. So it's interesting, you know, just thinking about transhumanism is how, if we just sort of think about what the Bible teaches of the Christian hope for the future, it's remarkable how close that is to the dreams of the transhumanists. That we are promised transformation of every aspect of humanity, including our physical bodies, transformation of human knowledge, awareness and consciousness. I think of those astonishing words that Paul says, then we will know fully, even as we are fully known. Isn't that amazing? In other words, the knowledge that is promised us is of the same order of profundity and comprehensiveness of the way that God himself knows us. The ultimate defeat of death and pain and suffering, the transformation of relationships, of community, of being the bride, of being one, and this cosmic scale, the entire heavens and earth, the entire cosmos renewed. That is the vision that the Bible gives us of what is in store for the redeemed humanity and for the entire redeemed cosmos. And it's just striking how in many ways the transhumanist dreams are versions of that, but arguably much more reduced. It's a kind of secular eschatology. As I come to the close, I think one of the things that we need to reflect about is the way that salvation history is taught and thought. You know, I learned salvation history, this the flow of history that starts with creation and then with fall, and then God steps in the Christ event, and then there is the cross and the resurrection. And as is often said, that we live in this era between the two comings. But what is coming eventually is this, the new heaven and the new earth. And that's the way that Christian history and salvation history has been taught ever since the time of the early church, I think, in many ways. But something remarkable is happening in our time, which is this explosive runaway phenomenon of science and technology, and which seems to be self-reinforcing. It seems to have this unidirection. And the question is, how on earth does this phenomenon, which we are seeing in our present age, how does that relate to this traditional understanding of salvation history? And what are God's purposes in all this? I think this is something which we as scientists are much more aware of, I have to say, than our non-scientific Christian brothers and sisters, who are sometimes rather unaware of the extraordinary things that are happening in the world of science and the pace, the rapid expansion of scientific knowledge and of the technological abilities and so on. And I think we need to reflect on this. What is God doing? What is God saying? How can we understand these processes and how they fit in with God's providential ordering of history? So to conclude, I think I would suggest critical vigilance. We need to try to understand the signs of the times. We were instructed by Jesus to, you know, that you can understand the weather, but you can't understand the signs of the times. So we need to watch and pray, try to understand what is happening. Don't be afraid. It's possible to think that, you know, what is taking place is completely out of control. And I think we can be confident that God's sovereign purposes are being worked out in the unfolding of history. We're called to play our tiny part in the great drama. I often reflect on the parable of the wheat and the weeds. I think it's one of the most mysterious and strange parables that Jesus gave, where it's clear that it's part of his plan that good and evil should grow together in the harvest of the world, apparently inextricably intertwined, almost indistinguishable. And it does seem to me that as we look at these explosive growth, or the potential for good, but also the potential for evil, the wheat and the weeds seem to be inextricably intertwined, and that's a part of the phenomenon. At the final age, they will be separated. At the final age, it will become clear. But for this age, it seems that the good and evil will be inextricably intermingled, and we need great wisdom and discernment. I think we need to celebrate original model humanity and unenhanced human nature and behavior, because this is the form in which God became flesh. I do wonder whether there's going to have to be, sort of in the future, like there are campaigns for real ale, I wonder if there's going to have to be campaigns for real humanity, you know, and that we'll have to say, actually, you know, if this kind of humanity was good enough for Jesus, then it's good enough for us too. It's good enough for us to do the ordinary human things of having meals together and talking face to face and having families and the things which human beings have done for thousands of years may be something that we're going to say, have to say, this is really important. This is a fundamental part of our humanity. And we need to reflect on the significance of Christ's bodily resurrection, God's final vote of confidence in our embodied human nature. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, John, for that really inspiring first talk. Now, he's left us some time for questions. So we have a mic that's going to be taken to the questioners. Okay, I think that was probably the first, but then you next.
Thank you, John. That was fantastic. I want to reflect, or would like you to reflect a little bit further on that the slide of the arrow from creation to new creation. Because I was quite intrigued how, you know, you've drawn the red arrow taking us in a new direction. And of course, there's this, the question, is this a diversion from God's plan? Is transhumanism taking us to a bold new world, which is terrible? And is it the new Tower of Babel? And God will, you know, intervene to stop that if we don't stop it somehow ourselves. Or could that arrow be drawn in parallel as part of God's plan, which would be the optimistic transhuman, I mean, not that a lot of transhumanism are Christians, but, you know, the idea that, absolutely, you know, if we are to engage with a move away from the earth into the cosmos, well, then we will need to evolve into more machine-like abilities and such things.
Absolutely. I personally, and I don't want to steal Justin's thunder, and we know this is an issue we're going to debate during the day. I personally would want to say that in a world where there's so much that is wrong, in a world where so many people are dying from treatable diseases, where there's so much poverty and hunger, and that to invest serious resources in transhumanism seems totally inappropriate at this point. But if one could imagine that we, in some time in the future, who knows, 20, 30, 50, 100 years' time, we happen to live in a world in which effectively the same kind of advances that have been done in treating human diseases that are happening in the rich West were now happening across the globe, where everybody had available this kind of healthcare, everybody had available this kind of technology and health, that perhaps at that point it would become appropriate for Christians to say, well, can we see cautiously how we can use the technology to enhance humanity. I wouldn't want to rule it out completely as saying by definition it's something that's wrong. It's just I would say that at the moment it's very low priority because of there's so much that we could do using the technology that's currently there. Just the other thing to add, and that is there's a very interesting and helpful distinction which Jürgen Moltmann, I think, has introduced, that he points out that there are two understandings of the future, and he encapsulates it with two Latin words. There's one Latin word, futurum, and there's another Latin word, adventus. And futurum is the future as it emerges out of the present. It is the continuation of present trends. And in terms of secular future thinking, future prediction, that's the only thing that secular people have. And that is all they can do is say, well, what are the trends happening now? How can we extrapolate them into the future? It's the future as it emerges from the present. And partly that God works like that. God works in using natural historical trends in order to achieve his purposes. But there is also the concept of Adventus. And Adventus is when God steps into human history and does something completely unexpected and completely different from what came before. And a very good example is the incarnation. I mean, who expected God to turn himself into a human being? I mean, that just wasn't on the radar screen. And yet God enters into, in the Advent, the original Advent, and completely changes the nature of history. Well, how do we know whether something like that might not happen again? Whether at some time God is going to break in a completely unexpected way, and do something new. So as Christians, we hold together these two things. On the one hand, we look at futurum, how the future is emerging, but we also are open to the possibility that God at some stage is going to do something completely unexpected. And we have to be open to that possibility, our ever-surprising God.
Thank you. We had one gentleman before you, and then you're next.
Thank you very much. Do you see degrees of personhood that we are, that you said we are sub-persons in relation to the Trinity? How would you see higher apes and things as well?
Thanks. And that's a really interesting and difficult question. I think traditionally personhood has been seen as a sort of all or nothing phenomenon. And certainly when it comes to humans, I want to defend that. You know, I want to argue that the pathetic brain-damaged premature baby is as much a person as the Nobel Prize winner. That personhood is not something that is a sort of continuous variable. I think the question of non-human animals and primates, I would want to say that they're more like an analogous person. I think that when a much loved pet plays a very significant part in the lives, as we know, of some older people, many people, the pet is invested with all extraordinary qualities of humanity and courage and insight and loyalty and all that kind of stuff. I personally would say I'm not sure that that really qualifies as genuine personhood, but I can see that it is an analogous person and therefore needs treating with respect and concern. But I would hesitate about saying that that was the same as the personhood that we as human beings have in God's image.
Thank you. And our last question.
So I had a similar question in a way. The difficulty I see is that even within the church, there's a limited understanding of the Trinity and the three persons within. And so to use personhood as a fundamental understanding of the difference between people and the most advanced robotic machines is fundamentally very satisfying, but might not serve as an explanation to a lot of people. And I wonder if there's a good explanation in any book, that probably isn't time for it here, to say, you know, people do, to the secular attitude, as you put on the screen, is very much that we are no more than fancy machines. How do you distill the fundament, that gut difference that there is, but for non-Christians?
Thanks, and I think that's a real challenge, because unfortunately for most Christians, I think the Trinity seems like a sort of puzzle, a sort of a mind game of how you can be one and three and three and one, and it isn't something that's particularly nourishing or helpful as a... So I think there's a huge amount of work to be done in trying to find ways of communicating this Trinitarian thinking in a way which ordinary people can grasp. I think Buber's distinction between an I-you and an I-it is a simple but perhaps quite a helpful way of distilling that, of what's the difference between an it and a you. And that although these machines may feel like a you, it feels that there's someone there. Actually, there isn't. It's an it that's masquerading as a you. Incidentally, you probably noticed that I haven't used the word soul. You see, the traditional distinctions has often been that human beings have a soul. The problem is, I think, you know, that's quite problematic, the concept of the soul. It raises all kinds of issues of Platonic philosophy, and I think many people feel that the Christian understanding of the soul historically was very much affected in an unhelpful way by Platonic and other Greek philosophy. And so the idea that human beings have a soul and machines don't have a soul, I mean, it's simple, it's attractive, but actually I think it's not very helpful. And so I personally think we should avoid soul language, and we should, I think, personhood language communicates better in the modern world.
Thank you. Let's thank John again. Thank you.